I'm just going to introduce Kristen and then have some brief discussion with her after the talk, and then we'll just go straight into a discussion with the audience. People are probably familiar with some of Kristen's work. It's about 20 years, I guess, since I've been reading her work. She began in the early 80s working on Lefebvre and was one of the first people to Lefebvre. Henri Lefebvre is now very fashionable in urban geography, but in the early 80s wasn't really known apart from his early work in relation to dialectical materialism. But the work on everyday life was introduced in many ways into Anglo-American audiences by Kristen and Alice Kaplan in their special issue of Yale French Studies on Everyday Life back in 87? 87, yeah. She then wrote her first book, which is in some way linked to the talk tonight, actually, which was on the invention of social space, which was on Rambo and the Paris Commune. She wrote a book on decolonization in France in the post-war period, Fast Cars, Clean Bodies, which was a kind of study of metaphors of hygiene during that process. She recently wrote a book on May 68, part of the Cycle of Returns, which was a book that was in many ways about the cycle of returns to May 68, which has also just been translated into French, which is a rare compliment from the French publishing industry to non-French texts. She's also, she was the translator of Jacques Rancière's Ignorant School Teacher, which is a book, one of the early Rancière books, that one of the first books in English back in 91, which is in many ways a kind of foundational book for Rancière's politics, a book that a lot of people return to these days. But tonight she's going to talk about Democracy for Sale. Yeah, Kristen.
Thank you, Peter. And I just wanted to begin by situating my remarks tonight in terms of a debate that got started in France a few years ago. Actually, it was begun by people in the sort of center-left, people like Marcel Gauchet and Pierre Rosanvallon, people associated with the so-called anti-totalitarian left. And they began to complain about the erosion of democratic elections, in not just in France, really in all of the so-called advanced democracies. And this was met then by a book that had an enormous popular success by Alain Badiou, entitled Of What Is Sarkozy the Name? And in this book, Badiou argued that electoral democracy is not a space of real choice. And he was joined at that point by Zizek, who argued that only popular violence would allow the poor to make themselves be heard in liberal democracies. And this was brought up again in the context of the recent insurrections in Greece. Now, this kind of an argument was then met in turn by people, the sort of new philosophers, you know, Bernard-Henri Lévy and Pierre Assouline, who attacked Zizek and Badiou by saying that this was the return of a rhetoric associated with Stalinism, and that to be against democracy was to be for dictatorship or totalitarianism. So the thing got kind of locked in an old dilemma. And in order to break out of that, one of the more interesting editors over in France, Pierre Azin, who's the editor of La Fabrique, one of the better small presses now, decided to do a volume where he asked a number of people the same question. And the people were people like Jean-Luc Nancy and Badiou and Zizek and Rancière and Agamben, Wendy Brown, and me. And the question was, are you a Democrat? Or to what extent can one call oneself a Democrat today? So We were all supposed to answer the same question. And I was very flattered to be in such company, but I am not a philosopher, and I am not a political scientist. So I had to figure out a way to answer that question, and this is my talk. So my talk is called Democracy for Sale, and it's in two parts. The first part, I called it Cuchulainn versus Kushner. Cuchulainn being the Irish national hero, but then an Irish friend of mine told me that's not how it's pronounced. It's pronounced Cuchulainn. And so I liked it originally for the sound, so I kept it. So it's actually Cuchulainn versus Kushner. Am I a Democrat? Democrat, at least for Auguste Blanqui, writing in 1852, was a word, as he put it, without definition. What is a Democrat, I ask you? This is a vague and banal word without any precise meaning, a rubbery word. Is Democrat an any less rubbery word to embrace in our own time? In June 2008, Ireland, the only country to hold a popular referendum on the European Constitution, voted to reject it. One of the principal authors of the treaty, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, was the first to admit that the text of the treaty, which ran to over 312 pages in the English version, was little revised from the version that the French and the Dutch had rejected 3 years earlier, when they too held a referendum by popular vote. Giscard said, "The tools were exactly the same. They had just been rearranged in the toolbox." The same treaty, in other words, was being re-voted after having been rejected by the French and the Dutch. This time around, it was a quirk, as the mainstream media regularly called it, a quirk in the Irish Constitution, which gave the Irish the right to approve or disapprove the treaty by popular vote, when all the other countries, including now France and Holland, were to be represented by deputies. A mounting mood of suspicion toward the Irish vote was palpable in the European press, who viewed the quirk as a potential occasion for irrational and destructive behavior on the part of the public. The Irish, after all, like the Third World, might lack the political sophistication to make the right choice. They might not be ready for democracy. The suspicion boiled over in the days immediately preceding the election when French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner took it upon himself to make clear to the Irish that they were, in effect, obliged to vote yes out of gratitude to a Europe that had dragged them out of the bogs. It would be, he stated, quote, "very, very annoying for the right-thinking people if we couldn't count on the Irish, who themselves have counted heavily on Europe's money," unquote. The division he had established between the Irish, cast now as brigands who had absconded with Brussels cash, and the right-thinking people, presumably all other Europeans who have learned to regard politics as a giant inter-country game of treaties, summits, and committees, had been suggested a few days earlier by Daniel Cohn-Bendit. He wrote, "The Irish have gotten everything from Europe, and they are not conscious of it," unquote. The language of a new and technocratic Europe barely masked the repetition of colonialist tropes of older empires. The Irish figured as the latest rendition of the uneducated and unteachable people whose appropriate response could only be gratitude to its leaders. But there was a new twist. Irish support for the Constitution was viewed as an obligation of repayment. An investment, it seems, had been made, and the EU wanted a return on the investment. As President Sarkozy reportedly told his aides, quote, "They, the Irish, are bloody fools. They have been stuffing their faces at European expense for years, and now they dump us in the shit," unquote. The referendum was supposed to be nothing more than an exercise in rubber stamping the experts' text. But the Irish decided to treat the vote as a real vote. In their decision to reject the treaty and their refusal to align themselves with the powerful nations, some heard an echo of Bandung. The Irish were constituting themselves not only as a minority, but as a different kind of minority, those whose recent history had been a colonial one. Others, after the election, expressed what they took to be a general explanation for the treaty's defeat. The reluctance of Irish voters to approve something they had been told in advance they were incapable of understanding and should leave to their betters to administer. As one no voter put it, "The reason the treaty went down to defeat is that we Irish voters found it to be an impenetrable reed and an impossible thing to get our collective heads around. The treaty was purposefully drafted to defy our understanding." It was purposefully drafted, in other words, to communicate to voters through its very form that it was best to leave such complex matters of governance up to the experts, the technocracy. EU officials were quick to blame populism for the defeat. The Irish, they insisted, must be made to re-vote, presumably until the correct result could be reached. Valéry Giscard d'Estaing and Nicolas Sarkozy immediately called for a new vote. Giscard went on the radio. Giscard, "The Irish must be allowed to express themselves again." The radio interviewer, "Don't you find it deeply shocking to make people who have already expressed themselves take the vote over?" Giscard, "We spend our time revoting. If we didn't, the presidents of the Republic would be elected for all eternity." Sometimes there is all the time in the world to vote again. After all, the treaty was itself a revote after the French and Dutch had defeated it. Other times, as in the contested Bush-Gore U.S. election in 2000, there is no time to revote, nor even to recount existing votes. In the impoverished rural area in the Hudson Valley where I live, we pass our time revoting. Our county ranks near the bottom, which is to say with counties in Mississippi and Alabama, in the mediocrity of its school system, a mediocrity measured in terms of the ratio of money spent per student and uniform test results. Our county spends the highest amount of money for the worst results. Yet on the rare occasions when voters manage to vote no on yet another inflated school budget in an attempt to hold bureaucrats accountable, the same exact proposal, accompanied by a renewed chorus of warning against abandoning our kids, is put up for a vote month after month after month until it succeeds. Revoting, then, in today's actually existing representative democracies is nothing unusual. No, apparently, doesn't really mean no. What was striking about the aftermath of the Irish vote was not only that a treaty pronounced dead by popular vote was still very much alive, but that through exercising their democratic right to vote, by taking the election seriously, the Irish, in the view of the EU oligarchy, had struck a blow not against the powers of the parliament, but against democracy itself. Here is Hans Geert Pottering, president of the European Parliament. "It is, of course, a great disappointment for all those who wanted to achieve greater democracy, greater political effectiveness, and greater clarity and transparency in decision-making in the EU, that the majority of the Irish could not be convinced of the need for these reforms." The proof, it seems, was in the numbers. 500 million Europeans had been taken hostage by 862,415 Irish, less than 0.2% of the European population. The leaders of the large nations, France and Germany, reacted. Axel Schäfer, SPD leader in the German Bundestag, "We cannot allow the huge majority of Europe to be duped by a minority of a minority of a minority." Wolfgang Schäuble, German Interior Minister, "A few million Irish cannot decide on behalf of 495 million Europeans." Jean Daniel, "A country of 4 to 5 million inhabitants like Ireland cannot hold hostage countries made up of 490 million citizens." Now, presumably among the 490 million Europeans held hostage by Irish banditry could be counted the French and the Dutch, who had themselves voted no on the Constitution earlier, but we won't quibble over numbers. What is more interesting is to see the reappearance of a discursive figure, a familiar character who made its debut during the most recent historical moment of high panic among the elites, the 1960s, and that has been strategically conjured up at subsequent crisis moments, and I'm referring to the figure of the silent majority. When the silent majority appears, the world has been divided into two according to a quantitative logic whereby forces are presented in both numerical and moral terms. The law that a silent, reproachful, and now purportedly oppressed majority must defend against a stigmatized and vocal minority. A civic and majoritarian Europe hijacked by a subversive and destructive minority. The silent majority appears when the largest number is spoken for rather than speaks, and when the voice of the minority is increasingly voided of authority and rendered illegitimate. Now, you'll recall that the term silent majority originated in the mouths of Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew as they attempted to counteract the noisy opposition to the Vietnam War out on the streets. In France, the first use of the term came from none other than Valéry Giscard d'Estaing back on May 19th, 1968, which is to say at the peak of the insurrections of May 68. And he was just an insignificant deputy in southern France at this point. He said, "In our democracy, it is the duty of each citizen to prevent minorities from imposing their law on the silent majority of the country. If that majority acts like sheep, it will awaken to the reign of the colonels or that of minority agitators who, without taking account of existing laws, will impose their own. In the grave national circumstances our country is undergoing, I want merely to express the point of view that I know to be that of the greatest number of students and workers and of French men and women everywhere. This majority wishes that order be restored and liberties be protected. Up until now, the greatest number of French people who love order, liberty, and progress and who accept neither arbitrariness nor anarchy have remained silent. If necessary, they must be ready to express themselves." In the 1960s, the indeterminate silence of the greatest number could be confidently translated or ventriloquized by government officials as expressing a bastion of good sense against anarchy or arbitrariness. The minority had seized speech in the streets, but the highly valorized silence of the majority could function as a vast reserve army, a force held back until the moment when it would be called upon to express itself in the legitimate way, that is, by voting. In 2008, the silent majority, the greatest number of Europeans, finds its silence just as confidently translated by the ruling elite, but its silence is now constrained to be eternal, democracy as voiceless assent. The situation is one in which those who are deprived of their political say function comfortably in the belief that governability, and this was a concept that was massively promoted in the 1990s, governability. Governability benefits everyone, despite the fact that governability actually consists of the most unlimited wielding of power by the most powerful and wealthy classes. Indeed, another way of looking at the Irish referendum is that the Irish, invested with the specter of democracy as lawless or violent, were being asked to vote away their right, as well as everyone else's, to ever vote again by helping force through a ruling bureaucracy insulated to a virtually impermeable degree against democratic accountability. The EU had made an investment in Ireland, and the interest they required as a return on their investment was either the abrogation of the right to vote, or what amounted to the same thing, the obligation to keep voting until the correct vote, assent, was obtained. Governability, the creation of faraway, supranational European bureaucratic bodies against which no workers' organization can fight directly, is designed to prevent radical minorities in wealthy or overdeveloped societies from upsetting the system in any way. In 1968, many of the minority engaged in direct democracy out in the streets viewed elections, the tired, ritualized exercise of representative democracy, as, in the famous words of Sartre, a piège à con, a trap for assholes. What the gap between our own time and the 1960s indicates is, first of all, a progressive dismantling of universal suffrage, which is to say the attempt to deprive even representative democracy of its validity in the effort to offset the unpleasant effects of universal suffrage, and in favor of rationalizing people's will and the expression of that will. The term consensus is no longer adequate to describe what is in fact a kind of socializing of people into silence, silence as consent. But it also says something about the creative bricolage-like capacity of the demos when even a ballot box can become a weapon. It suggests that democracy can reassert itself via the most diverse of political forms. By taking an outmoded ritual seriously when, as Giscard's cynicism makes patently clear, no one else does, even voting in this instance can become an instantiation of fugitive democracy, the political potentialities of ordinary citizens. The vote could be treated as a weapon to be used in the anti-democratic assault on popular sovereignty by a Europe that presents itself as the reign of democracy on earth, a brand name sold by evoking peace, justice, and above all, democracy. Okay, this is part two, democracy for sale. The modern received understanding of democracy is rule by voting, the authority to decide matters by majority rule, the rule of the greatest number. But another understanding of the term, familiar to readers of Jacques Rancière's The Ignorant Schoolmaster, conveys a sense of power that is neither quantitative nor concerned with control. It is rather one of potentiality or enablement, the capacity of ordinary people to discover modes of action for realizing common concerns. Rancière's encounter with Joseph Jacotot and his continuing reworking of that encounter have helped make available what was in fact the original, more expansive and suggestive meaning of the word democracy, which is namely the capacity to do things. Democracy is not a form of government, and it is not concerned with number, neither with a tyrannical majority nor a minority of agitators. In ancient Greece, as classicist Josiah Aubert points out, of the three major terms designating political power, these would be monarchia, oligarchia, and demokratia, only demokratia is unconcerned with number. The monos of monarchia indicates solitary rule. The hoi oligoi of oligarchy indicates the power of a few. Only demokratia does not provide an answer to the question, how many? The power of the demos is not the power of the population, nor of its majority, but is rather the power of anybody. Anybody is as entitled to govern as he or she is to be governed. Yet if democracy as the capacity to do things is free from the law of number, it does presuppose an existing division of the world into two, a division between those are who are defined as having the capacity to participate in collective decision-making, the best people, and those said to be without that capacity. Democracy refuses this division as the basis of organizing political life. It is a call for equality on the part of the people defined as not being among the best people. Now, the best people have been defined in different ways throughout history, as those who possess noble birth, those who are of the right race, those who exhibit military power, as the wealthy, or those who possess complex knowledge or managerial skills. And as Emmanuel Wallerstein reminds us, the modes of defining who count among the best have always been accompanied by assumptions about the ethos or lifestyle of the best people. Assumptions, for example, that a civilized nature is their particular endowment. When Blanqui in 1852 complained about the rubbery nature of the name Democrat, he was already registering the profound modification the term was beginning to undergo, a modification that would last throughout the Second Empire and beyond. Up until then, the word had largely retained its revolutionary 1789 heritage. Democrat was, for example, the label of many far-left organizations in the 1830s and 40s. But during the Second Empire, the imperial regime had effectively appropriated the term for itself, for the most part successfully, by opposing what it called real democracy to the bourgeois party of order. In other words, the emperor claimed to have given sovereignty back to the people by the plebiscite. Monarchists in the 1850s and 60s embraced the word, equating it favorably with empire. The Minister of the Interior, an impassioned Bonapartist, was able to call himself the defender of democracy. By 1869, just a partial enumeration of the kinds of Democrats that were flourishing in French political life included socialist Democrats, revolutionary Democrats, bourgeois Democrats, imperialist Democrats, progressive Democrats, and authoritarian Democrats. The list reflects both the point Blanqui was making, that the term was entirely up for grabs, as well as the effort made by some socialists to affirm the revolutionary heritage of the word by lending precision to their position with an appropriate qualifier. But the word on its own, then, like today, conveyed virtually no information. Blanqui was not the only socialist to hesitate to use a word his adversaries were using to describe themselves. As he writes to his friend, "You say to me, I am neither bourgeois nor proletarian, I am a Democrat. Beware of words without definition. They are the preferred instrument of schemers. It is the schemers who invented the beautiful aphorism, neither proletarian nor bourgeois, but Democrat." What opinion could not manage to take up residency under that name? Everyone claims to be a Democrat, even the aristocrats. Democrat, then, no longer named the division to be overcome between those judged capable of governing and those judged incapable. It was too rubbery, it did no labor, it created consensus rather than division. Even the communards of 1871, engaged in their short-lived experiment in taking control of the administrative and institutional functions normally reserved for the elites, did not call themselves Democrats. The declaration of the communal form of government in Paris in the wake of the French capitulation to the Prussians signified nothing if not the most renewed commitment to democratic politics in modern times. In its brief existence, the communards replaced long entrenched hierarchic and bureaucratic structures with democratic forms and processes at every level. Yet these agents of democracy preferred other words, le peuple républicain, to describe themselves. But I think it's significant that they did not entirely abandon the word democracy. Even though it had been derailed from its true meaning and had fallen into the hands of the enemy, it still retained the heritage of 1789. When Arthur Rimbaud entitled one of his last prose poems, Democracy, a poem written soon after the demise of the Commune, the title is nothing more than a banner under which a mobile and imperialistic bourgeois class expands out from the metropolis to the languid, scented lands, feeding, as the poem says, the most cynical whoring, destroying all logical revolt. I think I've got a slightly different translation than the one that goes. I'll read my translation. You can read that, but they're going to sound different. Okay, toward that intolerable country, the banner floats along. The rattle of the drum is stifled by our patois, our jargon. In the metropolis, we will feed the most cynical whoring. We will destroy all logical revolt. On to the languid, scented lands. Let us implement industrial and military exploitations. Goodbye to all this and never mind where. Conscripts of good intention, we have policies unnameable and animal. Knowing nothing of science, depraved in our pleasures, to hell with the world around us rolling, this is the real advance, forward march. What if it were Rimbaud and not Baudelaire, who we could read as the poet who best compiled the central tropes and figures of the 19th century? With images courtesy of Edgar Allan Poe and Jules Verne, with prophecies drawn from political pamphlets, with figures taken from children's novels and popular science texts, Rimbaud assembles the emblems and possible futures of his moment. And the colonial soldier is very much one of those figures, producing as many, if not more, of the principal postures, orientations, stereotypes, and directions, as does the rag picker or the flaneur, for the future of the 20th and 21st centuries. Democracy, the poem, and The Illuminations, the collection that this poem is taken from, stand on the brink of a mutating world system. Their moment is the inauguration of a world drawn together by colonialism, the moment when a genuinely bourgeois regime begins to install itself definitively. Just as significant, though, is what lies immediately before the writing of these poems, the class massacre that occurred in the heart of civilized Europe, the mass shootings of tens of thousands of communards in May 1871. It's easy to forget that by the end of that month, half of the shoemakers of Paris were dead. This attempt on the part of the bourgeois republican government to physically exterminate one by one and in totality, its class enemy, to kill all those who had engaged in the brief attempt to change the political and social order is quite extraordinary. And I'm just going to read to you from an eyewitness account of the bloody week in Paris. The executions were not just happening in the Luxembourg. They were shooting people down on the street corners, in the passageways between houses, against the doors, wherever they could find a wall to push someone up against. The banks of the Seine were witness to ferocious massacres. Below the Pont Neuf, they were executing people for 8 days straight. In the afternoon, gentlemen and ladies would come out to watch the prisoners being killed. Elegant couples attended the butchery as they would a play. In a corner of the left bank that surrounds the neighborhood of the Pantheon, a half dozen court martials were functioning. The mass killings were at the Luxembourg, but they were executing people at the Monet, at the Observatory, at the Law School, at the École Polytechnique, and at the Pantheon. They were shooting people at the Collège de France, based on the condemnations pronounced by a provost seated in the room on the left of the main entrance. There were continuous executions in the Maubert Market. 6 court-martials for this one neighborhood. For each of them, more and more deaths. The Luxembourg alone counted more than 1,000. As they advanced, the Versaillais installed sinister military magistrates, one by one in each square, whose only task was to organize the killing. Judgment didn't count. Around the large slaughterhouses, the Luxembourg, the École Militaire, La Roquette, the Père Lachaise, the Butte Chaumont, and still others, countless massacres were conducted in a more muffled fashion with less ostentatious display and less glory. Now, I've quoted this eyewitness account because I think we should sort of linger on the sheer magnitude of the hatred exhibited by the bourgeois Republican government on the furious hostility of the majority. For this class massacre, this event, was the defeat of democracy that gave birth to the Third Republic. In November of that year, Rimbaud and his friend Delahaye walked the streets of Paris, examining the traces of bullet holes left in the walls of houses and of the Pantheon. The months and, in fact, years after the massacre left a political atmosphere infused, as Rimbaud remarked to his friend, with annihilation, chaos, all the possible and even probable reactions. The illuminations open onto the movement of late 19th century expansionism and the wholesale creation of a consciousness conducive to reproducing a colonialist expeditionary class this entailed. In certain of his more futuristic poems, Rimbaud foresees that movement culminating in a bland and homogeneous universe. A little world, pale and flat, as he puts it in one poem, or in another, the same bourgeois magic wherever your baggage puts you down. In others, he shows us some of the ways the bourgeois imagination intoxicates itself with apocalyptic images of its own death. In this cluster of poems, Rimbaud presents the canceled future of a now vanished imperial destiny. A panoramic vision where fantastic cityscapes rejoin ancient prefigurations of the end of the world in geological cataclysms of exploding ice and snow, intertwining bridges and highways lie flanked by barbarian tribes, a recurring planetary conflagration at once polar and fiery, chaotic yet eerily still. How can the future be imagined after the demise of the commune? Having lived the eruption, evolution, and liquidation of that unusual experiment in democracy, faced now with the swamp, as he called it, of the French middle classes consolidating the colonial impetus that would propel them through the next few decades, Rimbaud chooses to prefigure both the triumph and the death of that class in a series of futuristic and fantastic prose poems. The triumph of that class in a progressive homogenization of the planet and its death in an exploded earth. Now, the point I'm making is that this poem actually marks the precise moment when the term democracy is no longer being used to express the demands of the people in a national class struggle, but is rather being used to justify the colonial policies of the civilized lands in a struggle on an international scale between the West and the rest, the civilized and the non-civilized. Rimbaud recounts that saga in the Bad Blood section of A Season in Hell, and he provides an additional class portrait of the civilizing missionaries in a poem called Movement. This is just part of this poem. These are the conquerors of the world, seeking their personal fortune. Sport and comfort accompany them. They bring education for races, for classes, for animals within this vessel, rest and vertigo in diluvian light, in terrible evenings of study. The resonance of democracy, Rimbaud registers, was definitively changed, not merely diluted, but filled with an alien content as the very groups who feared it at the beginning of the century begin to embrace it at century's end. As in Rimbaud's poem, democracy becomes a banner, a slogan, a proof of being civilized, as well as the vital spiritual supplement, the ideal fig leaf, to the civilized and civilizing West. The state, in the name of representative democracy, inaugurates a history of class massacre within Europe in the form of the Commune and beyond in the colonial domains, a violence whose echoes can be heard in the language of threat and contempt directed at the Irish at the time of the 2008 vote. The West, as democratic, can become the world's moral leader since its hegemony is the basis of progress throughout the world. From these conquerors of the world to Woodrow Wilson's Making the World Safe for Democracy, and on to Harry Truman's recoding of democracy into the language and project of development economics, requires no leap at all. But before we leave Rimbaud, we must consider in the context of these two poems a third poem that may have as much to say to our own historical moment, a poem structured as one long advertising spiel entitled Sale. Whoop. In an atmosphere made up of equally modern and magical installations, the poem presents the revolutionary cry and the advertising slogan as indistinguishable from each other in a generalized onslaught of consumer goods and services. For sale, bodies without price, outside any race, any world, any sex, any descendant. Both sale and democracy, the two poems, relate changes in consciousness to the relative penetration of market relationships into everyday life, whether these be in the colonies or in the heart of the European metropolis. What might be called the prophetic or extraordinarily contemporary feel of these poems, and if you read them together, that's my title, Democracy for Sale, has something to do with the way that the 20th century solidified the equation between democracy and consumption begun in Rimbaud's time, democracy as the right to buy. Today's Western liberal democracies are all the more assured in their well-being that they are the more perfectly depoliticized and lived as a kind of falsely timeless ambience, a milieu or style of existence, a lifestyle. And this is the atmosphere envisioned by Rimbaud in Sale, the free exchange of merchandise, bodies, candidates, lifestyles, and possible futures. Now, today, democracy is the slogan of almost all of the leaders of the planet, and the rest, sooner or later, will be brought forcibly into the fold. What separates our own time from the extraordinary moment of Rimbaud is something called the Cold War and its ending. In terms of the development of democracy, it is difficult to overestimate the enormous gain Western governments managed to consolidate when they successfully advanced democracy as the opposing counterweight to communism. They had actually gained control of the entire word for themselves, leaving nary a trace of its former emancipatory resonance. Indeed, democracy had become a class ideology justifying systems that allowed a very small number of people to govern, and to govern without the people, so to speak. Systems that seemed to exclude any other possibility than an infinite reproduction of their own functioning. To be able to call an unchecked and deregulated free market economy, a ruthless, no-holds-barred opposition to communism, a right to intervene militarily and otherwise into countless sovereign nations and their internal affairs, to succeed in calling all of this democracy was an incredible feat. To manage to make the market to be considered as an evident condition of democracy, and to have democracy viewed as inexorably calling forth the market, is an astounding accomplishment. It was considerably helped along, in France at least, in the reaction against the 68 years, as the French Revolution under the profoundly anti-democratic tutelage of François Furet was submitted to a patient labor of disconsideration, denigrated in comparison to the acceptable revolution of 1776, and ultimately affiliated to Stalinism and the crimes of Pol Pot. And with the end of actually existing socialism, we at last, it seemed, finished definitively with moments of rupture or conflict. And society could be, from now on, the place for uninterrupted democratic deliberation, dialogue, debate, and a perpetual regulation of social relations. Rambeau's moment, as we saw in Democracy, initiated the age of democratic empire, a natural, inevitable project designed to bring about a predestined future of the peoples or entities being developed. But democracy is just as much at work, as we saw in Sale, on the home front, where the main system of rule in a society is the economy, a vast historical force beyond human power, and where a silent consensus informs us that the equilibrium produced by the economy defines the best of all possible worlds. Is this a permanent contamination of the language of politics? Can I call myself a Democrat? It's certainly not enough to criticize in an incrementalist way the failed or insufficient democracy of this or that law, party, or state. To do so is to remain enclosed in a system that is perfectly happy to critique, say, the blatant seizure of electoral procedures by a Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, but remains powerless before the same process when it is accomplished by economic phenomena that respect democratic rituals, like the exactions of the IMF. In fact, the understanding of democracy as having to do with elections or with the will of the majority is a very recent historical understanding. What is called representational democracy in our own time is said to consist of free elections, free political parties, a free press, and of course, the free market. This is in fact an oligarchical form, a representation by a minority who are granted the title of stewards or trustees to take care of common affairs. All of the advanced industrial democracies of today are in fact oligarchical democracies. They represent the victory of a dynamic oligarchy, a world government centered on great wealth and the worship of wealth, but capable of building consensus and legitimacy through elections that, by limiting the range of options, effectively protect the ascendancy of the middle and upper classes. So to conclude, I think we must both recognize this to be the case, that is, recognize the non-existence of democracy or its inversion in reality, at the same time that we acknowledge how vitally necessary it is to retain the original expansive sense of the term. If we remain enclosed in an understanding of democracy as a form of government, then we have no choice but to abandon the word to the enemy who has appropriated it. But precisely because it is not a form of government, because it is not a type of constitution or institution, democracy as the power of anybody to concern himself or herself with common affairs becomes another name for the specificity of politics itself. It may exist or not exist at all, and it may reassert itself in the most varied of manifestations. It is a moment, at best a project rather than a form. And as the name of the struggle against the perpetual privatization of public life, democracy, like love in one of Rambeau's many slogans, must be reinvented. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Kristen. Okay, I'm going to ask just a couple of reasonably general questions. Then we'll take questions from the floor. As you can see, my notes are profound. I guess my first question is really about It's really about the modernism of this French tradition that you're working with that runs in a way from, you know, Rambo through, you know, surrealism in a way, and Lefebvre into Ranciere's. And it's really a question about, if you like, the political ambivalence of the modernism of this tradition, and in relation, particularly in your discussion of democracy, because there seem to be two different and competing kind of political modernisms in your description of this tradition. And the first one is really kind of Blanqui plays Ernesto Laclau, I suppose, which is really that the kind of Blanquian moment of, if you like, treating democracy as a rubbery word, or, you know, which comes back, you know, it's kind of 19th century for empty signifier, is a tradition which, if you like, would vacate determinacy in some sense, and would, if you like, value democracy precisely for its indeterminacy, in the kind of Laclauian way. But on the other hand, you have this tradition of, when you use this phrase when you're talking about Ranciere, but I think you used it in your own voice, and you used it again at the end, where you talked about the true meaning of democracy. And this relates to something that I've always found odd about Ranciere's writings about politics and democracy in particular, which is how to interpret the kind of classicism of his reference to ancient models. Because there seems to be a kind of tension between the sort of modernist indeterminacy of this democratic space and this sort of proto-antiquarianism in a way, which is peculiar in some ways in Ranciere. I mean, you can interpret it, if you're feeling in a generous mood, as a kind of defamiliarization of the concept of democracy. But in a way, I more tend to interpret it in terms of the classicism of French philosophers never quite managing to escape the Greek tradition. So I wonder if you can detect beneath this convoluted question a kind of tension in this tradition you're talking about between, you know, the value of an indeterminacy and, if you like, the emancipatory value of indeterminacy, which seems to be one of the main things, and this notion of the true meaning of democracy, which I'm a bit dubious about.
Okay. Well, I think, first of all, I think with the Blanqui, he's not giving a value to indeterminacy when he says it's a rubbery word. He's saying that it's a stolen word. You know, I mean, it's more about the fact that at that historical moment, you know, when I read the list of all the different people that were calling themselves Democrats, you know, from every single political spot in the political sphere, everyone was calling themselves that. It didn't make it indeterminate, it made it stolen. So he says, you know, even the aristocrats are calling themselves Democrats. So it's about the appropriation of something rather than it being indeterminate. And I think as far as the, with Ranciere, you know, I guess I actually like what you said about the defamiliarizing, because I think that even those people who know something about classical Greece, or, you know, and if your question is why does that have to be the reference in some way, I think that's a real question. But to the extent that it is still for him to get back to the notion of democracy as the capability to do things, even that is not a common notion among classicists. You know, that's so he's so it's already. I mean, it's a defamiliarization of it even within the classical tradition. So he's. I mean. Yeah, in that sense, okay. I sort of went back to that. He goes back to that too, but he just as easily for him he could go back to someone like, you know, Joseph Jacotot and come up with the same thing. So it's not necessarily about a fetishism of, you know, classicism as some sort of founding knowledge or founding truth or founding etymology, since if anything, I think he, you know, the kinds of voices that he assembles in his writing, which include people like Jacotot, who, you know, no one, you know, legions of social historians who had been combing the archives of 19th century France never would have paid attention to Jacotot. And they wouldn't have paid attention to him precisely because he didn't fit the role of being a good worker, you know, and they were looking for workers who spoke like workers, and he didn't speak like a worker, so they ignored him. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that there's a kind of listening that he does to particular kinds of voices that I think you don't necessarily find among either philosophers or historians for that point.
Okay, but it does seem to be backward looking. I mean, it doesn't have to be Greece, but maybe the 19th century will do. But I wonder, in relation to the first part of your talk, if there's not a problem, if you like, in the backward lookingness of this tradition in relation to the kind of, if you like, the new terrain of something like, you know, transnational entities like the European Union. I mean, in other words, I wonder, are these models of true democratic meaning, which are so backward-looking, can they be sustained on these new spatial terrains?
Well, that's what I sort of was trying to do with the Irish vote. I was trying to turn it into a kind of contemporary instance of one of these democratic moments. And I think it remains. I mean, the irony is that, of course, the Irish voted when they were made to revote, they voted the other way, you know, just a few months ago, I think. But nevertheless, the first vote is now historically significant as a kind of, just as the, you know, the French vote or the Dutch vote. I mean.
But that does seem to sort of put this Ronsierian concept of democracy into the kind of beautiful losers category, right? They're the historically beautiful losers.
Well, yes, and I think that there, that is right in the sense that if you think that democracy is not a constitutional form, then it can only exist as a kind of a moment, but like the commune or this Irish vote or. You can call it beautiful losers, or you can call it a moment that has real political and historical significance, even though it doesn't take an institutionalized form, in the sense that, you know, moments are not to be trivialized. You know, in a moment is also momentum, and it's a you know, reconfiguring of possibilities. It's a way in which a moment can open up another entire course of time. It can disrupt what has been ongoing. And so, you know, it doesn't bother me that it does tend to be the losers in that sense.
Okay, I'm going to open this up to the floor for a bit and see if we've got some questions out there. This one there. The point of this microphone is because they record them, so it's not just to hear you. It's, I think, because it's recorded. This is why. Yeah.
Okay, I'll try. I'm not sure it works. I think I have two questions, one that kind of picks up on Rancière and the other one that refers more directly to your contemporary moment and the use of the Irish case. Mm-hmm. And in relation to Rancière, I think there is, you mentioned the call for equality and the verification of equality. And it seems to me that the indeterminacy of democracy, at least for Rancière, is limited in that sense. And my question relates to how equality plays a role in your contemporary moment, because some of the interpretation of the Irish case was based on the fact that they didn't understand, this is what you mentioned, which is the kind of direct opposite of, you know, Rancière's question of do you understand and the assumptions of understanding. Well, here there seems to be an assumption of not understanding. So this is one part. And the second part is about elements that I think are missing, or what you have said and what you haven't said about the Irish case, and about the fact that it seems to me that we end up being back into a dichotomy, a clean dichotomy again, similarly to, you know, good democracy and bad democracy, the emancipatory democracy and the non-emancipatory one. And I think that what needs to be said, I mean, in the Irish case and in the case of the EU, first, that there are different political formations, and I think this is important. But in the Irish case, when people were asked, they didn't say just that it was impenetrable, but they knew very well why they didn't want to vote, because the EU also meant people coming in from Eastern Europe. I mean, it's been not long ago that there has been a lot of violence against Romanian Roma in Ireland, that they were afraid of, you know, EU human rights, like, for example, the acceptance of abortion in Ireland. So how does this all fit? And I think there's something similar going on in Europe, which is a much more fractured terrain than I think it appears in a talk, where it's a much more monolithical oligarchy institution.
I guess my use of the Irish referendum was to really set up a distinction between a referendum which is an open consultation and very well might have included some people voting for the motivations that you've just said, but it was an open consultation, as opposed to the kinds of elections, say, that we have in here and in the States and in France, where you're choosing among an imposed set of possibilities. So on the one hand, you have the principle of the vote, which is very ambiguous. I mean, okay, yes, there's recognition of an equal value to each vote, but it's also a system that is organized to produce and reproduce a dominant personnel, the same faces in different windows. That's all we ever get. So it's there's really just a very, very tiny possibility of difference that occurs in an election. So I was just making the distinction between something like that kind of open referendum and what happens when you do that, where people take it seriously and they vote, and you know, it's not really the same sort of thing.
A comment and a question. The comment is for the last speaker there. I was in Ireland for the entire referendum time. There was violence against Roma, but not in the Irish Republic. It was in Belfast. And unfortunately, people in Belfast had no vote, and which is an interesting thing, actually. But I'm actually, if I can go back to the Irish thing, because it is of considerable curiosity, given there's an election due here in the next 6 months, and at the moment, everyone in this room pays tax to bomb Afghanistan, so it can become democratic in a sense. So democracy is actually quite interesting in that sense. What actually struck me in Ireland, where people did know what they were voting for, I saw more political activity in the street in my town in the west of Ireland than I've ever seen in London in the many years I've lived here. So people didn't know what they were voting for. But there were three things which occurred to me. there was a combination and the yes people who won by 2-1 of they were the establishment and they had an answer, vote yes. They also sold fear, what might happen if no was voted. One of the major difficulties of those who voted no, and I'm a no person on this thing myself, is that there was no unitary answer of any kind. And when you talk about the commune, for example, very interestingly, is a moment. The bother is that those who rule can call moment after moment. And the entire weakness of Ronsière is that he's happy with the moment, but you actually can't defeat global capitalism in moments. You actually need different names on which people can permanently mobilize themselves. And perhaps that goes back to your last couple of sentences, where you seem to have a notion of, if not a real, at least a better democracy. We, people who would oppose globalized capitalism, need at least provisionally some names, some slogans, some policies around which people can organize, else we will lose either beautifully or rather less so, time in, time out. And I think that really is where we need to go, is where are those moments in particular national or international formations?
Well, what are those names? What would those names be for you?
Well, in Ireland, you would have had to have named a different system outside what the European Union was offering, which really was threats. We will withdraw investment. Mm-hmm. And it's a country which, when I grew up there, was very, very poor. Everybody knows that. And there was genuine fear. But unless those who wanted to vote no could begin to come up with other answers, then, of course, people, a part of the voters did vote no, but not sufficiently to do more than shake the bars. But shaking the bars isn't enough. The cage needs to be dismantled. Mm-hmm. And that's where the names come in.
Well, I would say that threat, but also a kind of a medicalized discourse comes into play around something like that, where democracies in the inverted sense, which is global capitalism, tries to defend itself against anything like democracy by using a kind of medicalized discourse so that on a referendum like this, people who voted a yes vote on Europe was considered a sign of mental health or healthiness, and a no vote was considered a sign of illness, right, or pathology, and yet in a therapeutic model like that, there is no democracy. The doctor always knows what's best for the patient, and I think that was going on as well. I mean, that's also a kind of threat.
Sorry. Yeah, just to continue on this naming question, because I think it's... I went to a talk that Alain Badiou gave a couple of months ago, I guess, on the Sarkozy book. And one of the things I got from that talk is that he was saying that the situation, he was talking especially about France, is the failure of the left and the failure of an alternative and the failure of a name. And this name for him is communism. And how to rename or re... And it's interesting because I felt that the work you've been doing around the world of democracy has been doing around the world of communism. And I just wondered if you had anything to say about that.
I think it's very close. I think that at least in Ranciere's work, the kind of it be, what he talks about in terms of democracy becomes a figuration for politics itself. And I think, in a sense, it's interchangeable for him, communism or democracy. They become the same name for him. I think for Badiou, I'm not so sure. I think he's kind of associated democracy entirely with parliamentary elections and things like that. So he's able to just jettison the entire idea in favor of communism as the unique name through which to mobilize. But I think for Ranciere, they're actually the same thing.
You say that democratic moments shouldn't be trivialized. But then why, I mean, I agree with that, but then why is it you choose the Irish referendum as your democratic moment? Because it's still within the framework of liberal democracy. And as far as I can see, the only reason why they're able to have that referendum is because they're able to have a revote. And because actually it doesn't, it wouldn't really mean all that much if they win. I mean, and that's played out. Why is it that when you're looking for your moment, your democratic moment, you don't look to somewhere like Greece, not ancient Greece, but Greece in December last year, and then there you have got more potential for some kind of momentum.
I think you're absolutely right about Greece. The choice, I guess the point I wanted to make, see, it comes back to your discussion, is that in the breakdown of the debate in France that I was talking about, you had these people like Zizek and Badiou who were jettisoning the entire apparatus of anything resembling representative democracy or parliamentarianism and stuff. And I guess what I wanted to say is that I use the Irish vote instead of a more, I think, obvious example like the Greek example, partly because I wanted to say that sometimes even voting can be democratic. Do you see what I mean? Can be an instance of it. See, I don't really care about the forms in that sense. I think that these kinds of instantiations of what the American historian and philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls fugitive democracy, that it intrigued me that something like a no vote on Europe could even be interpreted in that way, in my sense, because it was a moment of a weakening of this large supranational institution, bureaucratic thing called Europe, and it was a moment of, in that sense, of a weakening of the institutional apparatus, and you could register it just concretely in terms of the panic in these officials in Germany and France. I mean, they were almost insane. I mean, with these things about Sarkozy, you know, saying publicly they've thrown us into shit, you know. I mean, just I'm always interested in that level of panic.
Any more questions out there? Or comments? Then we will happily conclude on this democratic moment. Thank you, Kristen. Thank you.